You are tuned in to Community Radio, WPVMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Mostly sunny across the mountains today, a high near 81 here in the city. Wind gusts near 20 miles per hour. Cloudy skies with a chance of scattered showers before midnight, then gradually becoming partly cloudy. A low around 33. It'll be breezy with wind gusts near 40 miles per hour. Sunshine on Saturday will stay on the chilly side. Breezy conditions, the high 58. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio. Fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today, I've invited my creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, to join us on the show. The reason why is because Allegra just recently finished presenting a terrific TEDx Asheville talk. Her subject was imaginative intelligence. I have a fair sense of what Allegra did to prepare for this talk because I helped her for the last 3 weeks. I was her performance coach. I also helped 5 or 6 other of the TEDx Asheville speakers work on their performances as well. I call it performance. You can call it a talk. What happened was they all stepped on the stage and they all knocked it out of the park. It was a terrific, terrific experience for the audience as well as for the TEDx speakers. So today, Allegra will unpack her experience developing her TEDx Asheville talk. This will be most especially interesting for you if you're thinking of developing your own TEDx talk and giving it somewhere in the world. So here we go. Tell us about your experience with TEDx Asheville, how you first heard about it, why you think it was interesting for you to engage in the TEDx work. What kind of process did you go through to get yourself to the end of the TEDx talk in Asheville and have it be quite exciting?
I don't know how I first heard about TEDx. I've known about TED for a very long time and watched TED Talks and stuff. And then at some point, I discovered that you were part of the TEDx Asheville crowd team putting on the event. And about whenever it was, 7 or 8 years ago, we had created a little series of books called Twice 5 Miles Guides, The Stuff Nobody Teaches You. And I wrote how to edit and be edited, and you largely wrote how to read for an audience, although we co-authored it, but it was mostly you. And then we thought, well, you know, what are other topics? And you suggested your old friend, Barry Barton, who has a company called Stand and Deliver Asheville that teaches people to make speeches. So I worked with Barry for a while on that book of how to make a speech, and we published it. And she is the person running TEDx Asheville. I don't think she was when we worked on the book. I think she took it over very soon afterward. Anyway, so I knew Barry and you. And the other thing I knew about TEDx Asheville was that possibly unlike any other TEDx in the country, if not in the world, there is a massive amount of support for the speakers, massive amount of mentorship from Barry, from another mentor called Jack Hannibal, and from you, James Nave. I would have gotten your mentorship anyway, but I knew that there was that level of support and a, you know, 3-month schedule of preparation, including 2 months of rehearsal. So if I was ever going to do a TEDx talk, I was going to do it here. I didn't want to just pitch up somewhere and give a talk that, you know, I've never given a TEDx talk before. I don't know how to do it. I don't think it's smart to think that, oh, you know, just because I know how to do some things, that means I know how to do other things. Until 2 days ago, I didn't know how to do a TEDx talk. So I wanted that guidance. It's every 2 years here. The last time I didn't really have a topic. But then when you and I started developing the idea of imaginative intelligence, and we were excited, were and still are excited about it because we both believe this is actually a really important insight into not just how creativity and imagination works, but into how that feeds into one's whole sense of self, then, okay, I have a topic. So I applied. I didn't just get straight in because I know people. I applied just like 269 other people.
And when you applied, did you realize there were going to be 269 other people?
I knew that it was, you know, a popular place to do a TEDx, we'll say. I didn't know the competition was going to be that extensive. But, you know, whatever. If there had been five other people or 5,000 other people, I was still going to apply. So I applied with the idea of imaginative intelligence, and of course then had to figure out what exactly I meant, because the first level of the application was a written thing where you had to say, you know, what's your big idea? Because TED is about big ideas, ideas worth spreading, and point one, point two, point three, and why should you give this talk? So already I didn't know how to answer those questions and had to understand a little bit more about what those points might be. And of course, I drafted my answers to those questions and sent them to you, and you helped me refine them. And so I put that in, and the next stage was going to be a 2-minute video. And I didn't know if I would go through to the next stage. I certainly hoped I would. And when the time for that video came, I would be teaching a memoir workshop in Nova Scotia. So I had to make the video in advance, even before I knew that it was even going to be required. And I remember very clearly feeling quite pleased with my version of it and sending it to you. And you said, no, absolutely not. That won't do at all. And you made me completely redo it. And then we had to record it, you know, still in advance of even knowing if it would be wanted. And I was recording it and you were like, no, not good enough. And you rehearsed me. And first you made me tell it to you like I was angry. And then you made me tell it to you like it was a secret. And I think there might even have been a third. And then you said, that's enough for today. We'll record it tomorrow. And the next day we found a place in my house where the lighting wasn't too bizarre and the background wasn't too difficult, and sat down to record it. And my hands were flying all over the place, as they do, since I'm Italian. And we were trying to get my hands out of the frame of the video. And it was just this wonderful discovery. You ended up just sitting behind the camera and holding my hands. And I could move my hands as much as I wanted, but they stayed below the level of the frame. And it was lovely because I really was connected to what I was saying, because I was connected to a real live, warm human being with both hands.
And for people listening who are thinking about getting a TED Talk, it might be worth mentioning right now, the 269 people who applied sent their applications in, written, as you said. On the TEDx Asheville side of it, Barry Barton puts all of the people who help her select the speakers into different groups: Group A, Group B, Group C, and Group D. So the applications go out to these different groups. Your application did not go to my group.
Of course.
Your application went to Group C. I'm in Group A. Group C passed you on. You were invited to make a video. Your video application actually arrived, and Barry took a look at the video application and loved it, and it got passed on, but it had nothing to do with me. And then when we finally got around to whittling it down to 18 people, that's when I did come on with Barry and had the interview. But by then, we had decided that yours was fine. So I don't even think there was an interview.
You passed me
process.
Through without yep. an interview.
That's right.
That was the third round. And, you know, I knew which 2 days I had to keep free. I was in the UK at that point, making sure that I had availability on the 2 interview days. And then Barry called me and said, hey, we're passing you through without an interview. Me and 4 other people. I mean, it's not like I'm so unique.
What I like about Barry's work, she is the leader. She's the director. She makes the decisions on who stays, who goes. So Barry made those decisions for the people who got passed through.
It's a long process. This,
right.
And that's Asheville. I mean, I think it's, you know, other TEDx's work differently. But Barry was very, very careful about curating the group.
Yeah. So what I'd like to ask you to think about and talk about a bit, when you first started to do this, and this is probably true with people out there in the world who would like to do a TED Talk, I remember you saying, well, I believe I can swing this. This is fine. I've got my subject together. I've prepared my speech, and I think my speech is fine. Mm-hmm. Tell us about why you thought it was fine, why you were so confident about it, and what happened as you moved through the process and how you refined your confidence to the point where you actually did, in the end, a couple of days ago, succeed at giving a fantastic TEDx Asheville talk.
Well, the whole thing started, when did I decide? I decided to apply in probably May or June. I did the written part of it, I think, was August. We made that little 2-minute video in September in advance of when it was required. Then I heard that I was through in early November. I had to come to Asheville in early December. That was the first meeting of all 12 of us with Barry. And then one of the requirements of doing a TEDx talk in Asheville is that you have to live within 4 hours of Asheville so you can turn up for the rehearsals and the events. Taos, New Mexico is well more than 4 hours from Asheville, more like 32 hours of driving. So I moved to Asheville for 2 months, rented this lovely little place that we're sitting in right now, Lake Eden Retreat, and just moved here, packed up my car with books and printers and, you know, whatever, and moved here for 2 months. And by the time I left home in, you know, mid-January, I was already on draft 3 of the talk. And I thought it was in pretty good shape. You know, I thought, yeah, I'm sure it's going to change a little bit, but basically, I think I know what I want to say. No, so wrong. I knew what I wanted to say, or I knew quite a bit of what I wanted to say, but I didn't know the order in which I wanted to say it, nor did I have the tone of voice in which to say it. Because in the past, whenever I've had to give a speech or some kind of presentation, I've never written it. I've composed it by pacing up and down, and I've only ever spoken it. It hasn't been written. But this time, because of the mentorship, we all of us had to deliver what we had in written drafts. So even though I've kind of learned to not do it on the page, I had to do it on the page in this case, which I'm very glad because, as I said, I was on about draft 3 when I got to Asheville. I ended up somewhere past draft 17. I stopped counting at 17. So it was probably more like 19 or 20 by the time we finished. Because it was that question of the gap between what I wanted to say and what people, the audience for the talk, both live and on eventually YouTube, would be able to follow, take in, and connect to. And there was a much bigger gap there than I had realized. And that's where Barry was incredibly helpful because she kept telling me, no, people aren't going to follow that. You're talking about something you already know, and you're not leading us. She has a metaphor for a speech, which is that, let's say it's a lake, and she says, you have to meet people on the shore and lead them into the lake of your ideas. Don't drop them straight into the middle of the lake. They don't know where they're going. So I was dropping people straight into the middle of the lake in those earlier drafts. And she got me to a place where I could meet people on the shore where they were comfortable and I could lead them into this idea of imaginative intelligence. I feel we all kind of know what our imaginative intelligence is. It's intuition, it's insight, it's so many things like that, but we haven't had a name for it. So in order to lead from people's felt experience into a concept. That was the challenge of shaping the speech in that way. And also making it a talk, not a speech. It's not called a TEDx speech. It's called a TEDx talk. So I had to turn it from a written speech into a spoken talk. And that was way harder than I thought it would be. I came here for 2 months thinking, oh, well, you know, I'll finish up this talk. I mean, it's a 12-minute talk. I've already got a draft of it and I've been on stage before. So I probably, you know, of course I'll have to rehearse, but I think I kind of, you know, I'm already more than halfway there. I thought, ha, how wrong could I be? And I thought, well, you know, and I've got these other things that I want to work on. I want to finish my How to Write a Memoir book. And I want to do my book proposal for Imaginative Intelligence book. I haven't done anything on either of them while I've been here. It ended up that I just had to focus exclusively on getting this talk into my bones so that I could talk it as if I was at a dining table. That was the goal, to be that conversational, but also to know it so well that I wasn't going to be searching for the words or go into my kind of default setting, which is, let me tell you. Let me tell you is not going to connect to anybody. But isn't this amazing? Is what connects to people. So I had to understand how to present this talk with that completely genuine enthusiasm, not with a sort of stage persona.
You're well-spoken. People listening to this show right now can hear that. You know what you're talking about. You've had a lot of experience with this. People might be hearing you speak and they might be thinking, well, how could it have been such a problem for her? What's going on here? It couldn't be that hard. And people who haven't had stage experience, haven't walked on a big stage in front of 500 people, what was so hard about it? What kind of things did you have to shatter to get through? How did your ego get in your way? What was going on there? Did you delight? Did you suffer? Did you do both?
I did both. Plus, 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 plus. I think I probably went through the entire gamut of potential emotions as I developed this thing. At the end of the day, I wasn't even aware of the cameras, although I did have to change my outfit the night before because my beautiful Yoji Yamamoto adjacent jacket, which I bought specially for the occasion, looked so dreadful in the photograph somebody took for me of under the stage lighting on the dress rehearsal day. I was literally changing my outfit 12 hours before I went on stage. So that was a camera issue, but I wasn't really, you know, the cameras themselves, I wasn't aware of. The most difficult thing is I kept feeling that I was getting contradictory notes. And it just really threw me because I really, really, really wanted to do this very well. And I wasn't doing it that well. As we were rehearsing, I was too, let me tell you, rather than, oh my gosh, this is so cool. One of my fellow speakers gave me the note to nerd out. So yes, nerd out. But it wasn't easy to nerd out and to be conversational while also speaking from my chest, not in my throat, and not having my hands fly around all over the place. Felt just literally like I was being told to, you know, jump up and down and lie still at the same time. It just seemed completely impossible to be conversational, but also to be aware of doing something different with my voice, doing something different with my hands, being on a stage with a mic. And, you know, you don't usually have a conversation in which you monologue for 12 minutes. That's not a normal conversation. So you will remember that I ended up screaming at you a couple of times. One time in the parking lot outside a friend of ours' house where we had both parked because it was a convenient place to park for a rehearsal. And I didn't realize, I think, how stressed I was about the whole thing until that day. because I had been given those two notes, be conversational, but also drop my voice into a less reedy place and project. And I don't think we'd even gotten to the hands yet at that point. So I just felt so confused. And I felt like, I can't do this. I don't seem to be built to be able to do this. I couldn't see a way of being naturally able to deliver a TEDx talk in the way I wanted it to be delivered, which is a way that people would connect to it and not be lectured at by me. I don't want to lecture people, but it seemed like I couldn't help it, even though that wasn't what I was trying to do. That just seemed to be a kind of default setting. And so the level of frustration at times during these last, two and a half, 3 weeks was just massive, especially since I thought I could do this. All the indications were, this is not my first rodeo. You know, I've been on stage before. I've written talks before, or not written, but I've given talks before that I haven't written, just spoken to develop. I don't have a problem with public speaking. I used to when I was in my 20s and I was a publisher. My mouth would dry up. My hands would be shaking. My voice wouldn't come out. I was terrified of public speaking. And that was just to 10 sales reps when I was a publisher, 10 sales reps that I even knew. And I was incapacitated by nerves. But I'd gotten over that because you trained me before I went out on my book tour for my memoir, Love Child. Nave trained me to be able to read from what I wrote in front of people and talk about it. So, you know, I'd gotten over that 15 years ago. I don't know why it was so difficult, but it was staggeringly more difficult than I thought it would be.
Well, I have an answer for why it's difficult to do that. It's difficult to do that because it is difficult to do that. And I'm not being snarky or anything else. There's a lot more at play than just walking out on stage and giving a talk. Anybody who's seen a magnificent talk given, they think, oh, they just, the person giving it just came off the top of their head, no big deal. There's a lot, really a lot behind it. I worked with, I guess, 5 or 6 or 7 of the TEDx speakers this time. We worked in a nice apartment hosted by Ashley Berger, who had us over for dinner. Her talk was all about inviting people to come to dinner. We also came to Lake Eden and worked in the performance barn with stage and audience seating, and everybody worked in the barn. So as I worked with the 7 people, my goal was to disrupt them as much as possible throughout the rehearsal process, push them to places they didn't particularly like and didn't necessarily want to be there. And then they would have to handle those situations. So for you, I pushed you really hard. Put your arms down. No, you don't have your images in place. Wait, I'm not hearing this. I'm not seeing the beam of light. I don't see Einstein. How about the story? Where is the story? Disrupt, disrupt, disrupt. The reason why, I know when you coach people, the more you can shake them up and really get them emotionally charged, angry, happy, sad, it doesn't matter. Get those emotions moving. When they finally walk out on that stage, they've taken care of all that other business. And now they're ready to deal with something that might happen, but may not happen. But if it does, they can deal with it. So you really fought often, and you screamed at me more than once.
At least 3 times.
At least 3 times. I think it was more than 3, but I'm not. I'll give you 3. 3 is a magic number.
Certainly might have been 4.
Anyway, the point is, I was glad you were screaming, because in the screams, you expressed so much. There was disruption, there was frustration, and there was also lockdown. You were locking things down that I've seen done before. You didn't know you were doing it because you'd never done it before, but you were getting yourself prepared to move into the big day when you walked out on the stage and there's 500 people there and you're recording your piece. Am I accurate in this?
Yes, absolutely. I want to be clear for anyone who's listening what you meant by my images weren't in place. We're not talking about slides here. we're talking about mental images, what you call in the How to Read for an Audience book, imaginative circumstances, so that I needed to get in my mind for pretty much every single phrase, not just even every sentence, but every phrase of the talk, some kind of situation in my mind. So the talk starts with a little story about Einstein. When he was 16, he imagined himself riding alongside a beam of light, and that was the germ of the special theory of relativity. So I had to also imagine Einstein riding on that beam of light, and which I had. And then the place where I say I was the uncreative one, knowledge was my currency, I had to imagine myself back being 15 years old, sitting with my dad and doing my best to impress him with what I knew. I don't know what was the most difficult part of the whole speech, all of it really, because I would so easily default back into lecture mode. But it was only the night before. So bad dress rehearsal, good performance, we hope. Bad dress rehearsal, yes. And after we go back to base after the dress rehearsal, I'm like, I need to rehearse some more. And I've been running this thing 20, 30 times a day for 2 months in its various iterations. So the idea that I was still not there shocked me deeply that night. And I trotted back down. We're both, you know, in different little buildings at this beautiful place of Lake Eden. And I trotted down to Nave's place and said, I got to rehearse this a bit more. You got to help me here. And it was only that night, literally the night before the performance, that we both realized separately, and then both realized that I had to imagine Einstein standing there on that red rug, not just riding his little beam of light, but actually there on the red rug before I even walked out. So I had that. It took some time, and I got there early on the day of the performance so that I could be on the stage where the red rug was and rehearse again and again and again, another 10 times, seeing Einstein on that rug before the other speakers even arrived while the tech guys were doing their thing. So he was there. And when I walked out, I could literally give an absolutely genuine smile at Einstein standing there on that red rug, smiling at me, waiting for me to tell his story.
And as we were rehearsing that last bit, this was moving around to about 9 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Call time for your talk was 8:30 the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
So
this
thing had not been locked down. And when I first proposed Einstein needs to be on the red rug, but you need to do more with Einstein than have him on the red rug. He needs to be big. You need to talk with Einstein. You need to be Einstein. You need to be Allegra. You need to interact with them. And if you can let Einstein join you in your talk, Einstein will follow you through the whole talk.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't invite Einstein along for the ride, you'll leave him behind.
Yeah.
And so to the rest of us. And you just refused.
Well, I refused. No, I refused because you stood there. I already knew that we both realized at the same time Einstein needed to be on the rug. But you stood there and you kind of caressed the outline of Einstein's imaginary body standing on that rug because you wanted me to make him physically real. What I refused to do was caress Einstein's body. That just felt really weird to me. I didn't want to caress him. I wanted to smile at him. I wanted to put my arm around his shoulder, which I did on the day. That was it. I had my arm around his shoulder. But what I was resisting was this caressing. I didn't want to caress him.
For me, it mattered not. You can caress Einstein or you can put your arm around Einstein. The main thing was get Einstein on the stage.
Exactly.
And
but I was, you know, I was on such a short fuse at that point that anything I was being told to do that I didn't understand or felt contradictory, I just flew off the handle instantly.
You did. You were really off the handle a bit. But I also knew that if we could get you moving in that direction where you were upset, you were frustrated, you knew the deadline was coming, let's get Allegra a little further down the line. And then you finally did it a couple of times. And I could see Einstein was there.
Mm-hmm. Einstein was totally there on that rug waiting for me both times I came out.
And we could see it.
Yeah.
And so that evening for the rehearsal, what did it sound like? Can you give us a sample of the opening just to give a feel for you and your relationship to Einstein, just so people can get a taste of how the talk will sound?
You want me to do the first couple of lines of the talk?
Just the first couple of lines, just to give folks it's fun to watch Einstein make an appearance.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I haven't prepped for this, so it may not be quite the way I wanted to, but I'll do my very best. This is how the talk begins. One evening in Denver, when Albert Einstein finished a lecture, a woman asked how she could best help her son become a great scientist. He told her, have him read fairy tales. You want me to carry on?
Just a little more.
Okay. Probably not the answer she was expecting. He meant, let him develop his imagination.
So, my friends, that's the opening. And what we did just now, Allegra and I had a bit of a conversation there, but that's how the rehearsal went. So as I'm watching Allegra, you're listening, I'm watching, she sees Einstein. Once Einstein is there, Einstein's not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that was absolutely fantastic. So she went through the rest of the speech, Einstein followed her through, and there it was. It was ready to go. She knew she had it. And then she could come up to her apartment and get a somewhat good night's rest, although I think he
well, as I thought,
morning.
But that was when I came up here and saw the photograph
oh, right.
of me in my Yoji that. Yamamoto adjacent jacket looking absolutely dreadful. So at that point, I had to grab a couple of other things that I might wear and trot back down to Navi's a place and say, what am I going to wear? Because needless to say, I didn't pack up my entire wardrobe to move to Asheville for two months, so I didn't have that many options.
So all of this is in service of getting on that TED stage. And so the day of the TED talk, everybody arrived. We had hair and makeup. All the speakers were well-dressed. Allegra managed to switch out of her outfit and put another on that worked really, really well. You were fifth on the stage. You were part of the morning offering. The afternoon
Fortunately.
Offering was the other
yep,
six people. So it was absolutely great. Tell us about your experience on stage at TEDx Asheville in front of all the people. What was it like? What was it like behind the scenes? How did your rehearsal pay off? What worked out for you?
Well, one of the most valuable things, again, a reason why I wanted to do this talk in Asheville and not at any other TEDx, is the care that Barry was taking, not just with mentoring us for the speech and the performance. She made it clear that the ultimate goal was not the performance on the day, but the video that will eventually go on YouTube. So she made it very, very clear that if we flubbed, it was not a problem. We could just stop, do the line again, because the video can be cut. So, and I also knew that one of the speakers last time had stopped halfway through and got a drink of water. So it was good that I knew that, because I, you know, had my different outfit on. I was number five. I prepped in the back, did a vocal warm up and, you know, calmed myself and got mic'd up and all that kind of stuff. And ready to come out, Amy, the MC, introduces me. I see Einstein there on the red rug. I've got him totally locked in. He's smiling at me. I'm not particularly nervous. I'm feeling really quite good about everything. And I come out and I start one evening in Denver when Albert Einstein finished the lecture. And I got about as far as the lines after what I just did for you just now. And my mouth suddenly went as dry as a desert. It felt like glue. I could hardly move my tongue in my mouth or move my lips or whatever one does when one talks. I don't even know. But I couldn't, it was glue. And there was no way I could possibly talk for another 10 minutes. It just wasn't going to come out, or it would have sounded like I was under about 50 feet of water or something. I don't know what it would have sounded like. So I just I had to say, I'm so sorry. My mouth has dried up so badly. I can't talk. I have to go get a drink of water. And so I did. And it wasn't quick because I hadn't left a water bottle right there at the side of the stage. Somebody had to go find my water bottle or get me a bottle of water or whatever. I can't even remember. So it took a minute or two. And Amy, our fantastic MC, Amy Clymer, went back out on the stage and, you know, filled up that time and introduced me again. And the good thing was that I was near the beginning of the speech, so I was able to just start at the top again. So she introduced me again, and I came out, and I still had Einstein there on the rug. He was waiting for me. He was thrilled that I was coming back. And so I just started at the top again. And thank God my mouth didn't dry up again. I was slightly afraid that it would, but it didn't. And I got a warmer reception from the audience that second time that I came out, because I guess audiences like to see that, you know, you're not perfect, you're human. So I really felt the audience rooting for me because of that problem, which fortunately I knew wasn't really a problem. I knew I had the permission, and I'm a good girl, so I tend not to do things without permission in somebody else's, you know, stage production, because I was just one of 12. It wasn't my production. But, you know, I was so grateful to have had the coaching that I could do that in order to make the video as good as it could be.
You handled it very well. It was easy. You came out the second time as if you had never been there before.
It was so funny. Having done that gave me a huge boost of confidence. So when I came out the second time, I felt so much more. I mean, I wasn't particularly nervous the first time, but it was kind of, okay, here we go, you know. But the second time I came out, I was so much more relaxed. For whatever reason, that departure to get the drink of water really helped. Who knew?
So when you are working on these kind of projects, TEDx Asheville, anything you do, that sense of push that brought you to the stage and the level of excellence that we were all satisfied with, you did a very, very good job. People cheered, stood up. Everything you wanted from a TEDx talk came. It was because of all of the work, the simple, simple lowercase, let's just run this thing again.
Yeah. Yeah.
People who do creative work and do it at a level that achieves that kind of excellence, they all report the same thing. I just worked and worked and worked and worked. And finally the day came and I did it.
And when somebody makes it look easy, you know, they put a lot of work in.
Yeah.
Because that's where the work ends up, looking like there was none at all.
So now as we move toward the end of our time together, tell us a little bit more about what you were talking about. We've mentioned imaginative intelligence. We are all imaginatively intelligent. Our imaginations are working all the time. We might not give them as much credit as we could.
We don't give our imaginations as much credit as we could. And particularly what we don't do is appreciate how huge an effect the exercising of our imaginations has on ourselves, on building courage and confidence in such a way that you can become fully grounded in your own life. This is where, to me, the concept of imaginative intelligence is so valuable. I mean, you know, we value imagination, we value creativity, we can call it intelligence, but it's more than that. It's more than imagination and creativity. As we discovered, I'm going to go back a little bit and give you the credit that is your due, because the first person out of the two of us to use the term imaginative intelligence was Mr. James Carl Nave Jr. on the phone as I was driving to Paonia, Colorado to do a workshop, and we were talking, and you said, you know, I don't think we're actually teaching people how to write. We're teaching people to develop their imaginative intelligence. And as soon as you said that, I thought, yes, that is so correct. And that is actually kind of, that's the dynamic of our collaboration and has been for quite some time. You throw out these fantastic ideas that come out of nowhere, quote unquote, they come from your imaginative intelligence. And my job is to catch them. I'm the catcher. You throw them out, I catch them, and then we start doing something with them. But if I don't catch them, you just keep throwing out more, and they, you know, and they don't necessarily go anywhere. So that's why this collaboration works so well. So you threw that one out. I caught it immediately that day. We were on the phone for an hour and a half. I remember this so well. And we started to understand that imaginative intelligence is something that you develop and cultivate by using your imagination, but it's far more than that. Because as you do that, you build your trust in yourself, you build your courage, you build your sense of yourself. So you become, you know, you stop having to kind of prove or defend or explain yourself. You know, things bother you so much less because you know who you are, and you don't have to be defined by other people's ideas of you. And who knew that all of this inner courage, inner strength, inner confidence could come simply from cultivating your imagination, letting it play, letting it do its thing, letting it be wild and not follow the rules. Because when you don't follow the rules, you know, when you allow your imagination to play and not follow the rules, you recognize that you are your own authority. And that's what, to me, is so exciting about this concept.
Something that's interesting about rules, because that comes up a lot in the workshops. I don't follow the rules. I'm not a rule follower, or I do follow the rules and it works against me. We all have our own indigenous set of rules that emerge from us as creative entities, as creative humans. Sometimes the rules that we try to follow are not the rules that are built into us.
Exactly.
Our imaginative intelligence, when we work it, and what I mean by working it is have a conversation like this and not spend too much time worrying about where the thing is going to go. Mm-hmm. We are doing a conversation. We're exploring this. When you let your imaginative, say that three or four times, when you let your imaginative intelligence out to play, or just let it function as it was designed to do. Mm-hmm. And because it functions as it was designed to do, it feels good. So we call it play. Mm-hmm. It establishes the kind of rules that you need to keep yourself whole, functioning, and moving
and
in
centered.
A forward-centered mm-hmm. way that works for you and not for somebody else. So the more you practice it, the stronger it gets. And the best part about it, unlike the muscles, you can only do so many push-ups before you tire out. Your imaginative intelligence never gets tired. It's always happy to do a little more something.
Indeed. Indeed. And yeah, I think that whole idea of like, oh, I don't follow rules, you know, I'm a rule breaker. Everybody follows some kinds of rules, and there's nothing wrong with rules. The idea of rules is what enables society to function. It's what enables us to function. There's a rule of don't run downstairs too fast. That's a rule. This is a very useful rule. So we all have our own rules, but as you say, so many of us take on other people's rules as our own and don't realize it. And that's when we start losing touch with ourselves. And the way to return to that core of self, not ego, self, there's a difference. I think this is a very important difference, one which I will be going into in the book I plan to write on the subject. It returns you to yourself, because when you let your imagination play and do its thing and surprise you, and don't shut it down with rational mind judgments, which you've almost certainly learned from other people, what's good or bad or makes sense or doesn't make sense. As I said, you enable yourself to be your own authority. And that is something that I think many of us struggle with, depending on our upbringing, of course. Not everybody struggles with it. But many of us grew up with other people's expectations and imbibed them and incorporated them as our own expectations without necessarily checking to see if they were in accord with who we are. And it's a very difficult thing to explain. Who are you? You can't, it's hard to verbalize, well, this is who I am, or this is who my beloved friend is, or my brother. Because the imaginative intelligence doesn't operate in words. So because of that, it's very easy for the rational mind to sort of shut it down and discount its value, because it seems not to be intelligent because it doesn't have words. You know, you just know something, but you can't explain it. You can't justify it.
And the imaginative intelligence, when it's active and when we're using it, what I mean by using it is pause for a moment and appreciate the sunrise and allow your imagination to take a full measure with you of that appreciation. You start to get a sense of discernment.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the rules we don't want to follow, or when I talk about them, and maybe you listening also, I think of something straight-edged. Mm-hmm. It's a straight-edged rule that has a sharp point to it, and I have to be there with my uniform on. The kind of rules that we're discovering in the imaginative intelligence approach have a more rounded kind of offering. They're the kind of rules that say, this is a good thing to follow. Like, mm-hmm. for example, you practice your creative work, you practice with your imaginative intelligence, and you realize, you know, I really am better served by going to bed early and getting up early. That would be something that would work for me. Or you might say, gee, I've always been a night owl, but I'm not supposed to be a night owl. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to go to bed at 10 o'clock. Well, your imaginative intelligence will say, here's a better rule. Go to bed when you feel like going to bed, especially if you're able to do the creative work and you're not locked into a time frame. Suddenly the rule becomes something more than a sharp edge, but it becomes a holistic part of your functioning.
It becomes a guide. Your imaginative intelligence is your guide. And the idea of cultivating your imaginative intelligence, and I want to make the distinction between developing and cultivating, because to begin with, we were using the word develop. Develop your imaginative intelligence as if it was, you know, a little tiny seedling or something that, you know, didn't have its full form yet. But the more we explored into the idea, we realized it absolutely has its full form, but you may not know it's there. So now we've kind of moved towards saying cultivate your imaginative intelligence. In other words, cultivate it the way you'd cultivate a friend. You don't develop a friend. The friend is already a fully developed person, but you can cultivate your relationship with that friend, just as you can cultivate your relationship with your imaginative intelligence, which will then, you know, give you that sense of being in yourself. And that's where watching the sunrise or the sunset comes in. And it may not do that for everybody, but I believe that your sense of awe and your sense of beauty are both parts of this network that is imaginative intelligence, as, you know, goes beyond imagination, beyond creativity. And when you are in those states of awe or appreciation of beauty, that chatter of your mind stops for a moment. And that chatter is your rational mind. And when it stops just for that moment, does usually that it doesn't stop for long. But when it stops, you are fully in your imaginative intelligence. So whatever that is for you, whatever makes you feel awe, you know, you don't have to go to Yosemite. You don't have to go to a museum. Watching a trail of ants can be awesome. I mean, since I've been here in North Carolina, I've got these big tall trees outside the window here, and I'm on an upper floor. The squirrels leaping around from branch to branch are absolutely awesome. I mean, I'd never realized how incredibly awe-inspiring a squirrel is until the last month. So when you do that and simply appreciate wonder for whatever reason, and I don't think that the neuroscience is even caught up on this one, but for whatever reason, that inhabiting of what does it for you? You know, whatever blows your skirt up, it's your skirt that's blowing up, not anybody else's skirt, your boat that's being floated. So the more you appreciate, this is my boat that's being floated, this is my skirt that's being blown up by watching this awesome squirrel or ant or this awe-inspiring sunset or night sky or this beautiful dead tree that's like the sentinel tree when you drive into Taos from the south. There's something about that tree, and you're nodding. We all know it. We all know that tree. All we have to say is that tree, and anyone who lives in Taos knows exactly what we're talking about. As you appreciate those things that touch you, that you being touched flowers.
And your imagination is the garden that you have had from birth. It's a garden you've been cultivating. It's not something you have to start.
And you had the freedom of it when you were a child. And very likely, somehow, that garden, your access to it got smaller. And maybe you eventually, sometime in your midlife, found yourself outside the gate looking in. It's not, it seems like it's not even yours anymore. The people who say, I don't have much imagination, or I'm not a creative person, they've somehow gotten shut outside that gate, but it's so easy to open that gate up.
All you have to do is open the gate, turn a little bit of soil over, and the garden will breathe a sigh of relief and respond well to you.
Yep, and say welcome. Welcome back. Not even welcome. Welcome back. This, I am your garden. I'm so happy you're back in it.
Allegra, on that note, I believe we've arrived at our time to say goodbye. So thank you ever so much for telling us a bit about what you went through for TEDx Asheville, and congratulations on an excellent talk.
Well, thank you for being there beside me, behind me, in front of me. None of what I have today as a writer and whatever I am, leader of, you know, creative writing workshops, I would have none of this if it wasn't for you. You trained me how to get out of my own way, because I was solidly standing, firmly planted right in my own way when I first met you. So you've really given me my good life.
And before we go, I have to say the same thing back to you. I've learned more than I could possibly have imagined working with you for the last 20 years.
And that's how collaborations work best, right?
Quite an education. So thank you.
Thank you.
And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Allegra Houston. If you would like to know more about what Allegra's up to, her website is Allegra, H-U-S-T-O-N, AllegraHouston.com, and also ImaginativeStorm.com. You'll be able to see the books that Allegra and I have worked on during the last 5 years, as well as an opportunity for you to connect with Allegra on the Saturday Writing Prompt of the Week gathering, which we host every Saturday. So there are plenty of ways to connect with Allegra, and she's wide open to discussing imaginative intelligence, as you probably gleaned by listening to the conversation Allegra and I just had. And finally, if you are interested in developing a TEDx talk and would like to have a chat with me, my door is always open. I would love to discuss it with you. You can reach me, Nave at jamesnave.com. Nave at jamesnave.com. I'm happy to talk to you for free about it. No problem. And the reason why is because the more I can participate in encouraging people to get out in public and say the things they feel are necessary to say based on their life experiences, the better off the world will be. So I'm wide open to it. Nave at jamesnave.com if you'd like to discuss that. And finally, TEDx Asheville has many opportunities to get involved with the TEDx Asheville community. You can find all that information at TEDxAsheville.com. So that's it for now, my friends. We are at the end of our time together. So thank you once again for taking the time to be with us on Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to. And remembering, I am James Nave, your host. Thank you, Walter Parks, for our theme song. WalterParks.com for more on Walter's music. Devine Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville. And Robin Collier and Mike Tilley, thank you for doing the same, managing KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio, in Taos, New Mexico. As I said just a moment ago, if you're interested in joining me and Allegra Houston any Saturday between 12 and 1 Eastern Time for our Imaginative Storm Writing Circle Gathering, we would love to have you. ImaginativeStorm.com. You'll be able to find the link there. You can also find that link at jamesnave.com. If you'd like to reach me, Nave at jamesnave.com, I would love to hear from you. Happy to engage in any kind of conversation you might want to engage in. And on that note, I believe that's just about it. So once again, thanks for being with us on Twice 5 Miles Radio. And I do hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
The radio is an art form, you know. We don't want it to die. And I'm afraid that the people that buy all the radio stations might forget that this is not just a tool to make money. It's part of our society. It colors the way we act, the way we treat each other. You know, it's much bigger than a tool to make money. It's an art form. So, but what's great, what's ultimately the best about it, is it's fun and it's entertaining. And that's all we want to do is raise that question of, hey, how come we're not having as much fun as we did?
Me. Noise upon the